I've never met you, yet never doubt, dear. I can't forget you. I've thought you out, dear. I know your profile and I know the way you kiss. Just the thing I miss on a night like this. If dreams are made of imagination, I'm not afraid of my own creation. With all my heart is here for you to take. Why should I quake? I'm not awake. Isn't it romantic? Music in the night, a dream that can be heard. Isn't it romantic? Moving shadows write the oldest magic word. I hear the breezes playing in the trees above, while all the world is saying you were meant for love. Isn't it romantic? Merely to be young on such a night as this. Isn't it romantic? Every note that's sung is like a lover's kiss. Sweet symbols in the moonlight, do you mean that I will fall in love perchance? Isn't it romance?
Joan Morris, the mezzo-soprano, William Bolcom at the piano, and his music by Rodgers and Hart, Isn't It Romantic, from their CD called The Rodgers and Hart CD, which came out in the early 80s, 1981, I think.
Gosh, I was about three, I think.
I'll turn my mic up. That was, you said you're about three?
I don't think so. Yes, right. Let's see, figuring forward, that means I'm only, actually, sometimes I say, when people ask my age, I say, I'm approaching 39. I just won't say from which direction.
From which direction, yeah. Fair enough. Well, that is the voice of Joan Morris, spoken, and also the voice of William Bolcom. That particular CD was my introduction to both of them. I don't remember who gave it to me or if I bought it on my own, but I always loved the music, the delivery, the whole performance, which we'll certainly talk about the notion of performance coming up. This is Live and Local on FM 90.9. I'm Kevin Kelly. The show is your connection to local performances, and that's not quite true today because William Bolcom is actually on the University of Illinois campus as a guest of the School of Music in residency officially. I think he's called the George A. Miller Visiting Professor these weeks. Had a Q&A session with some graduate students earlier today. He's going to participate in a composer's forum tomorrow and then in a lecture and panel discussion tomorrow early evening from 5 to 6:30 is called Rethinking American Opera, a lecture and panel discussion, featuring composer William Bolcom and also with various folks from the schools of music and theater and dance at the College of Fine Arts at the University of Illinois. That'll be at the Spurlock Museum on campus, and that's free. Anybody can go. And then he'll be working with some various performers and composition students, and also Joan Morris will be working with some students as well, specifically vocalists, on Thursday and Friday. So it's a real treat for me to have you both on, because I've always, as I said, from the beginning of that CD and hearing others since of your performance as a duo, I've always enjoyed really every aspect of it. And so it's a privilege to actually meet you.
Well, thank you.
And I've had two direct experiences, only two, I'm sorry to say, with, well, no, that's not entirely true. Well, with my own performance involvement with your music, Mr. Balcom.
Songs of Innocence and Experience. You were
Songs
at Grant Park, right, in 1986. You were in the chorus. You told me that.
I was. Grant Park, Chicago. And massive, massive work and fascinating. And I guess probably in some ways indicative of certain aspects of not only your composition but also of your career, because it mixes so many styles of composition, mm-hmm, from very modern sounding orchestral and vocal writing to, I think you had a folk singer, a rock singer, and I forget the other types of
singer.
Country singer.
I did that one.
And Joan, you were in that performance as well. Yep. Singer were you?
I did both the two folk songs, the nurse's songs. I did the Divine Image in the Songs of Innocence, and I sang the one about the dear mother.
Oh yes, the vagabond.
I loved saying that.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So marvelous. It's just a wonderful melange, I guess, of yeah, some of the things you do compositionally.
Uh-huh. Well, I was fascinated by the fact that the more I looked at Blake, I fell in love with William Blake when I was 17, and I was an English minor at the University of Washington, which was a very good time to do that because I got to study with the great poet Theodore Retke. And one of the upshot of that was that I was eventually able to get Leonard Slatkin to, and I really had to wrestle him for it, to do a fourth symphony in which I could set the whole poem, The Rose, which I'm so glad Joan actually was able to record with the St. Louis. That's on a New World, and I think that's one of the things that, if you don't have it, was one of the things I gave to Gail McGee. You might want to spend some time at least doing that, because that's something I'm very proud of. She did a beautiful reading, and it shows both her acting and her singing talents in a way that very few people could imitate. And unfortunately, nobody's been able to do it since. Mm. No, that was one nice singer I remember at Manhattan School who done it, but I think it's been very rarely done.
And I love the poem. I grew up in Portland, Oregon, so roses were, my grandma had beautiful roses. When I was a little girl, I would put my face up to the rose and it would cover my whole face, so I would have this beautiful yellow color around me.
Mm. So you set just a part of it for...
No, the whole poem, The Rose. The first movement is an orchestra movement called the Soundscape, which is sort of wild and crazy, kind of toccata for orchestra. And then comes this very long contemplative poem. It always makes me think of the sea along Gray's Harbor area of Washington State, which, mm-hmm, is always kind of covered with a big misty gray kind of thing, and there'd be wild roses, and it's about a wild rose in there, mm-hmm, and the whole thing makes him contemplative. It is a beautiful poem.
Did William Blake have something with roses? Because I think
so that's a famous one. When I was 17, I actually made two settings. The opening of the Songs of Innocence is actually the way it was pretty much when I in 1956 I had this idea, this wild raucous beginning. And then later in the Songs of Experience is the rose poem.
The sick
poem.
Rose.
Yeah, the sick rose. The rose hour sick, the invisible worm, and so on. And that was, those two things survived from 1956. And then later I sort of realized that I wanted to do a lot of thinking about it. And the more I looked at Blake, the more I realized that he was himself doing the very thing that you have pointed out about my music. All of the styles that he touches on in the Songs of Innocence come from, well, from the very high-flown imitations of Spenser and Dryden to the very kind of demotic and kind of folk-songy simple things, which I actually happen to have a couple of books called Songsters, which are little poems made to the tune of. So the same idea as the Beggar's Opera in 1728, of taking well-known tunes from Purcell or Handel and putting words to it, the same idea. And so I have these things. So that was, some of that feels very much like that same kind of thing in Blake. And so I said, well, you know, I can find parallel styles around that will But they came to me. I didn't say, gee, I'm going to do this and I'm going to do that. But, you know, what happened is an idea would come to me and then I would fight it off as hard as I could. And if it wouldn't go away, then I guess I'd have to use it.
So meaning that if a particular poem suggested a particular style of music, let's say folk music, even though you're supposed to be writing, quote unquote, a classical piece,
yeah,
you'd
right.
fight that off and then decide, well, no, I guess it needs
to
be a folk
song. Well, that's what
happened
to The Shepherd, for example, yeah. which is a straight country and western. And so when the recording we have, we got a hold of a very well-known folk musician who also played harmonica named Peter Mad Cat Ruth, who was known in the whole world in that whole area. And he comes up. I remember the first time he came to the rehearsal, he says, sure, I'm not sure I belong here. And of course, they all fell in love with him. And we had the great luck of having a wonderful, very special harmonicist who had a long career playing in the movies. He, you know, if you ever listen to the, you know, the, actually he has a part in Good Vibrations of the Beach Boys. And if you hear the score for Rawhide, he plays in that. And my friend Paul Chihara, who did the score for Rawhide, actually got us to know about him because they did a performance of the Songs of Innocence down with the Pacific Symphony, and there was Tommy, so we brought Tommy in. And so Mad Cat didn't feel lonely because he was famous, a guy, and they had mutual respect, and so he wasn't lonely anymore, and he did a fine performance.
Well, since we're talking about the Songs of Innocence and of Experience, music by William Bolcom, my guest along with Joan, his wife Joan Morris today, uh-huh. Let's just do a real quick survey. Just to, so
okay,
people can
how
hear
about
what
a little
we're
extract of the opening?
Sure.
And then we can go straight, if you want, to The Shepherd, which is the one that I was talking about with Peter mm-hmm. Madcap Ruth. You can see what I did there.
Let's give it a listen. And this is a performance by a lot of forces at the University of Michigan, School of Music, where both of you were on faculty quite a long time and retired.
And Leonard had actually done this piece several times. He'd actually done it at St. Louis. He'd done it in New York with St. Louis. He did it with BBC Symphony. So I knew he knew it very well. That's why
Leonard Slack and the conductor. Mm-hmm. Here on Live and Local.
Shepherd's sweet heart, from the morn till the evening he strays. He shall follow his sheep all the day, and his tongue shall be filled with praise. For he hears the lamb's innocent call, and he hears the ewe's tender reply. He is watchful while they are at peace, for they know when their shepherd is.
church is cold, but the alehouse is healthy and pleasant and warm. Besides, I can tell where I am used well. Such usage in heaven will never do well. But if at the church they would give us a meal and a pleasant fire our souls to regale, we'd sing and we'd pray all the livelong day, nor ever once wish from the church to stray. Then the parson might preach and drink and sing, and we'd be as happy as birds in the spring. And modest Dame Lurch, who is always at church, would not have bandy children or fasting nor birch. The barrel, but kiss him and give him both drink and apparel. Ah, ah,
His nest has made in its thickest shade. Through
Thank you.
Well, that was a real whirlwind tour of a massive composition by William Bolcom, Songs of Innocence and of Experience, all those poems by William Blake, performed by soloists, choirs, the University of Michigan School of Music Symphony Orchestra, University Musical Society, conducted by Leonard Slatkin. And Thomas Young was the initial, I don't know that we ever got to him actually in the first song. And then we heard Peter Mad Cat Ruth also playing harmonica, and Joan Morris, who is with us also today, in The Little Vagabond. We heard the men's chorus, and one of my own favorites from that, My Pretty Rose Tree. And then finally, a fellow named Enman Ford, and then Nathan Lee Grimm.
A final, very complex explanation from Blake of the mess we're in, you know. And I can see what he's saying. I find so many things that are still very true about what he said. And then this long transition, which then takes you into a reggae, which is in memory of Bob Marley, and done by Nathan Lee Graham, wonderful actor and singer. And that's the ending of this whole 2.5-3 hour piece, you know. It's
an incredible traversal of musical styles, as well as of those particular poems. This is Live and Local on FM 90.9. I'm Kevin Kelly. Our program is made possible with support from Community Blood Services of Illinois, working together with volunteer donors to provide blood products for hospitals and patients throughout our region. Blood donations help save the lives of the injured and critically ill. Information is available at bloodservices.org. William Bolcom is on campus this week as a visiting professor in residence for a few days, working with composers. And also tomorrow we'll be participating in a lecture and a panel discussion called Rethinking American Opera from 5 to 6:30. That's going to be in the Knight Auditorium of the Spurlock Museum on the U of I campus in Urbana. It is free and open to the public. And then he and Joan Morris coaching various performers on Thursday and Friday on the U of I campus. Both are my guests here on Live and Local today. I want to just ask, actually, when I listen to something like that, I always like that, by which I mean where you have really busy, to say the least, orchestral music, and then elsewhere some very complicated vocal writing, and then the relative simplicity of things for folk singer, rock singer, and so on, and then the reggae at the end. What goes on in your head to come up with all of that?
It's something that I couldn't tell you any better than anybody else. I just write what I hear. And when something is suggested to me, I just listen to it until I have it right, and I write it down.
What's your background getting into music, just generally?
I was kind of a child prodigy. Very, very young, I was already playing piano at the age of 4. And when I was 5 and 6, I was starting to do regular repertory and as a pianist. But I always wanted to be a composer, even back then. And both Gilbert Kalish, the pianist, and I have had similar histories with our parents. Both families were approached to try to put us out on the stage as child prodigies. During the Second World War, there was a real fad for little kids coming out with leg extenders playing Mozart concertos and short pants. And they were going to put me out there. And this we were then living in Seattle, and I remember there was this a couple people had driven up from Los Angeles just to come and listen to me and talk to me and try to talk my parents into putting me on the road. And my mom, who had had some, you know, teacher training, said, "Well, will he have a chance to be with other children?" And I said, "Well, I'm sorry, no. He'll be raised by tutors, and he'll be taught, and he'll have to be going, because he'll be having this concert career. He'll be all over the place." And they talked for about 2 seconds, and I think one of them said, "There, so I would do that to our dog." So I'm very thankful they said no. And Gilbert Kalish is probably thanking his parents every day for the same thing, because it's a very rare person who has been able to come out of that. I guess one of the things that's phenomenal is Hilary Hahn, who was certainly very much of a child prodigy, has matured into a mature
violinist.
And there are very few who can make that transition. I remember Michael Rabin, who was the sensation of 13, and I knew him toward the end of his life, and he was quite kind of depressed a bit, I think. You know, it was very hard to deal with. You're no longer a little kid, you know, what are you going to do? And, you know, sometimes people are sort of sheltered, that, you know, developmentally, they don't go past a certain point and that happens. But, I mean, I'm just glad I wasn't thrown out to that because, you know, many people who have been through it, I've known one person who was actually a friend who was pushed as a prodigy in her teens, and I don't think she ever got over that. And it's a terrible thing to do a child unless it's somebody who absolutely is, well, I don't know. I'm so glad to hear that Hilary Hahn is surviving this, but there are very few people who do.
Stylistically, did you get exposed early outside of just, you know, the music that as high school kids and older and younger?
Oh, I was always open to listening to pretty much absolutely everything. I never made a judgment on any other basis about either it was good or it wasn't. This was not necessarily true with my teachers, but that was to be expected. That's all right. I mean, they were trained in the way they were. And when I was 11 years old, I'd been taking lessons down at the University of Washington. But 11 years old, I was doing one day a week, going down Thursdays to the University of Washington. We were living in a town 30 miles north of it. And I would have my piano lesson and my composition lesson, and I would sit in theory classes, and I would go to a thing called the Composers Forum, where all these students were playing their own music and so on. I'd spent the whole day there. And so I was already halfway out of school when I was already in high school. But I certainly was aware of everything else. I played in the dance bands, and I put myself through school with there was a very small scholarship that covered my tuition, which in those years, in 1955, was $900 a year to go to the University of Washington. You can imagine now, people will go into debt for half their lives. And no other money. My parents didn't have any money, so I actually had to earn everything else myself. I got to know a guy who actually turned out to be one of the producers of O Calcutta when I went on Broadway, Mark Dempsey.
Wow.
And he lined me up in the most incredible jobs. I played everything from college dances to burlesque shows to stag parties to every darn thing I could do. So I worked for female impersonators. I worked, you know, all kinds of gigs all over Seattle and sort of kind of the rough underside of the whole thing. And then I would finish my gig at 2 o'clock, take the Greyhound bus to my parents' house, sleep for about 3 hours, and then play 6 o'clock mass at this local Episcopal church in Everett, Washington. And so my whole life was skewed between one kind of another kind of thing. And so I just realized that my whole attitude was going to be sort of actually very open-ended in both ends. And I suppose that probably was a big influence on me.
You suddenly reminded me a little bit of Shostakovich's story, in that he played for, I guess, well, things a lot like that as a pianist, and
sure,
lots of popular elements sneak into some of his
like
lesser
the Tahiti
known
Trot,
pieces.
Which is made
Tahiti
out of
Trot,
Tifer
yeah.
Do, yeah, right.
Right.
So, no, it's true. He's got something of that same kind of, and then Mahler too. There's all those little kind of little tunes all over the place, which sound like the tunes he grew up, you know, in this small town.
Mm.
So I mean, this is something that was actually common in many of the previous centuries, but someplace in the art for art's sake movement or the kind of purism or all the various isms that would invade art through a good deal of the 19th century and the 20th century, you know, purist notions started taking over. And I think that's really kind of not true with a lot of things. Even Bach has a little joke at the end of the Goldberg Variations, and Haydn tunes are regular dance tunes, some of them, you know, and there was no problem with that. You can find, even in the medieval masses, they would use a dirty song as a cantus firmus, and so there's always been a mixture of this and that in most of music, but we became very purist and very oriented toward this or that notion. So I guess my biggest battle is composer and as a musician has been trying to work against all that. What I loved about the Blake works is that he was able to use all kinds of sources, and you know, in his poetry for the Songs of Innocence Experience. And I said, well, this is why I felt very strongly tied to him. I'm very interested in his philosophy. My Eighth Symphony is a setting of the prophetic books, parts of them, of, you know, the very difficult, knotty things that I did this for James Levine and the Boston Symphony with the Tanglewood Festival Chorus. You can get the recording from bso.org, and it's a good thing to have a text to follow with, because it's very, very tough words, but as fascinating. But the last section is quite takes the top off your head, because it says, for everything in life is holy, and mm-hmm. Everything that lives is holy, I meant. And this has sort of been my faith ever since. Anybody asks me what religion I have, well, I think that's true. Everything that lives is holy, so there.
And so as an active performer, you've had cabaret music in your life always.
And in one way or another, yes.
And then at some point, you met this woman here, Joan Morris.
Uh-huh. Yep.
Which was how? How did you
Well, that was through a girlfriend of mine. We had been in an off-Broadway tour, and we became good friends. And when we came back to New York, she met and married this artist. And when she became pregnant with their first child, her husband said she became an amateur matchmaker, an amateur shotgun. She was a Jewish girl. And so she did eventually introduced six couples. Three of them got married, and we were one of them.
You were one of them.
And so she had the touch for a while. What she told me about Bill, she says, well, I met this guy. You might like him. She said he used to be a classical musician, but he's given all that up. He's playing ragtime. Well, she was an actress.
I was very much involved with the ragtime revival. In fact, I had a lot to do with finding Treminisha, and I got the editor to put together the collected works of Scott Joplin and all the other things. So I mean, I had a lot to do with getting it going. I became close friends with U.B. Blake, and he and I used to concertize together. And
you had three projects on your desk when we met, I remember. One was the book, Reminiscing with Sisson Blake. One was your eighth
string quartet,
and the other was Treminisha. You were doing an orchestration of that. And it took us a while to work together because I wasn't looking for an accompanist. I had an act with a harpist then. The week I met Bill, I started what ended up being 10 weeks at Peacock Alley at the Waldorf Astoria.
You know, I was afraid of going to listen to her because I had been married twice. In both cases, they were talented, but they could never get their acts together, and I think that probably one of the real tensions was I was able, and they probably couldn't the resentment to that must have had something to do with our breakup.
Oh, he told me he was never going to get married again. It was too painful. And I was like, thank you for telling me the truth, you know. We're only going to be together as long as we're happy.
Well, I was also afraid of listening to because I thought, oh my gosh, what if she's not good? And I'm afraid I'm falling in love, and that's going to be the same problem again. And then I heard her, and I said, oh my God, she's marvelous. She's what I've always hoped that somebody would do. And I think that cemented it. Not that I was really worried, but I think I'd already begun. But I had no idea that you were as good as you are.
Well, usually a marriage is like a three-ring circus. There's the engagement ring, the wedding ring, the suffering.
Well, we've been together 41 years now.
And performing 72. At least 40 of those.
Well, yes, exactly. Yeah. We started January of 1973. So
we met in March 72.
That's right. But, you know, we didn't hurry to get working together. We didn't. We never met in a studio or anything. It was just...
we knew one song for about, 7-8 months, 10 Cents a Dance, because my grandma had been a theater organist in Mandan, North Dakota. She played for the silent movies and, my claim to fame, she had a dance band, and in her band was Lawrence Welk. And she's supposed to have said to him, Lawrence, you're too good for North Dakota. When I told Bill that, he says, well, she was wrong. But look, he's still on, PBS.
That's right.
5 o'clock in the morning, there he is. No, maybe it helped that he wasn't all that good because people could relate to him. And but he's perennial. He'll be there. He'll be there as long as the pyramids.
It does appear to be that way. Well, here's a sample of Bolcom and Morris from actually a live performance, the Aspen Music Festival, 1989. People will recognize the song.
Sweetheart by her side. Through the window pane, she looked at the rain. We must stay home, Joe, she cried. There's a picnic, too, at the old Point View. It's a shame it rained today. Then the boy drew near, kissed away each tear, and she heard him softly say, till the sun shines, Nelly, when the clouds go drifting by, we will be happy, Nelly, don't you sigh. Down lover's lane we'll wander, sweethearts, you and I. Wait till the sun shines, Nelly, by and by. For a trolley ride, just to show my brand new gown. Then she gazed on high with a gladsome cry, for the sun came shining down. And she looked so sweet, on the big front seat as the car sped on its way. And she whispered low, say, you're all right, Joe. You just won my heart today. Now everybody sing. Wait till the sun shines, Nelly. When the clouds go drifting by, we will be happy, Nelly. Don't you sigh. Down Lover's Lane we'll wander, sweethearts, you and I. Wait till the sun shines, Nelly. By and by.
Well, we heard in order, we heard sort of a twofer there. We heard Wait Till the Sun Shines, Nelly, a tune everybody knows, sung by William, played on piano by William Bolcom and sung by Joan Morris from a live concert in 1989 at the Aspen Music Festival in Aspen, Colorado. And then I segued into a piece that if you are a longtime viewer of our companion station channel, well, it used to be Channel 12, WYLL-TV, and remember the show called The Silver Screen, which aired old movies. Tom Guback was the host, and that was his theme music, and it was The Graceful Ghost by William Bolcom, which was played here by Paul Jacobs on Live and Local on FM 90.9,
right.
Somebody you knew well.
Yes, he was a very close and dear friend. I was very much involved with the ragtime revival, which is why Francie thought I was just doing nothing but ragtime. That's okay.
Which is why I wanted to play that.
Which is great. I'm glad you did that. It's a good thing to do. Paul was one of the fantastic pianists. He used to have a lot of the avant-garde material, but also played. You still may even have the Nonesuch Complete of the Debussy Preludes and of the Debussy Etudes, which for me are definitive recordings. The complete Schoenberg piano music he also did, but he also did one called Blues, Ballads, and Rags, which is that particular
recording. That's what
recording
that one was, yeah.
And we were very close friends. I would sometimes, he often played the New York Philharmonic when they're doing a Prokofiev symphony or something like that, and it might just be before the half, and so I'd go back and then we'd go out and have dinner. And I wrote a set of early piano etudes and up to 1966. Which I actually recorded myself, and this is now long out of print, but I know, I think the Naxos will be streaming that recording. They're eventually trying to maybe play all my piano music Naxos music library. But anyway, the next set of etudes I was writing for Paul. This is the 12 new etudes. And he was one of the first people in the whole musical community that anybody knew that was dying of AIDS. And I would go and see him about every month when I was back in and forth in New York all the time. And to see the progress of that disease is horrifying. And about the last week, I finally brought you up to see him. Mm-hmm. And it was just very sad. He just had an Erard piano sent to him of the kind that Chopin played. And he said, could you show me how it sounds? I can't play it anymore. So I played a little bit of a Chopin waltz. And that was Thursday, and he died the next Monday. And I was heartbroken. I'd written eight or nine of the pieces of the 12. And I'd sketched out the other ones, but I just was so bummed. I didn't think I was ever going to finish them because I was just heartbroken. In 1986, Marc-André Hamelin learned the first nine. And he played them, I think, at Saratoga Festival, possibly. And then I was so excited by the fact that he'd done them that I got home and I barreled myself in my little studio. And I think you brought me sandwiches. Mm-hmm. I don't think I've slept for three nights. And I just finished the last three, which are probably among the strongest of any of them. Then that year, Mark premiered the whole set. That's what won me the Pulitzer, because of the performance being so terrific. That's also, I think, on New World. You can get that anytime.
Right.
The 12 New Etudes. That's...
Pulitzer Prize, that was what year?
1988, I think.
1988. And since we've heard some of the songs of Innocence and Experience. No, it wasn't that. Which was the one, several Grammy Awards? It was that performance.
Yes, I got four of them. I got one of them. The choral director got two. Which is fine. I don't care.
Yeah.
But I have my own Grammy, and I posed for it so I could send pictures to my sister.
Oh, yes, your sister could see it.
And Joan Morris been nominated for a Grammy Award.
Yeah.
Well, let's remind listeners that my guests are William Bolcom and Joan Morris. There is William Bolcom participating tomorrow from 5 to 6:30 in a lecture and panel discussion called Rethinking American Opera. It's going to be at the Spurlock Museum on the U of I campus. Again, 5 to 6:30. It is free. It is open to the public. Other participants include Julie Gunn from the School of Music, Tom Mitchell from the Department of Theater, Rebecca Nettle-Fiel from the Department of Dance, and it'll be moderated by Jeff McGee, who's the director of the School of Music. And they Joan and Bill were brought here by Gail McGee, also on the musicology faculty. Mm-hmm. And then they'll be doing coaching sessions with various students in composition and instrumentalists, pianists, vocalists, accompanists, sort of demonstrating the Catholic tastes and abilities of both of you. This is Live and Local. I'm Kevin Kelly. Our program on WYLL is made possible with support of the Friends of WYLL and in part by a grant from the Illinois Arts Council, an agency of the state of Illinois. What do you tell students when they ask you, how should I write music? I'm sure they never have a question quite as open-ended as that.
No, they generally have too much of an ego to ask that question if they're composition, but not all of them. I think the biggest problem I've ever had was to, first of all, one of the things as a teacher, and I never really felt I taught, I think it was more of a mentor, was to find out what the deficiencies were. I think that every composer needs to have a full technique. And that means you have to have your harmony, your counterpoint, and your orchestration, and your knowledge of the history of the rest of it. And at the same time, do what you really want to do, and that's including your own background. When I started teaching at the University of Michigan in 1973, everybody wanted to be George Crumb. And so we ended up all these little crumbs. They didn't add up to a cookie, but they're all these little people trying to do Lorca and so on.
And most people who are listening have no idea who George Crumb is, which probably tells you something.
Well, George Crumb in that day was a man to, in that time, in the 1970s, he was a man to beat. Everybody wanted to be George Crumb. He was the most famous composer.
Among composition students.
Among composition students, but also in all the classical music world. I mean, a lot of his music was brought out by Nut Dunsach. This piano music was played by David Burge, who just recently died. Wonderful performances. And George is one of the sweetest people I know. He's a wonderful guy, has still a very strong West Virginia accent. But anyway, everybody else is trying to be Crumb too. And finally, I had to find out something. I said, the best way for me to find out, they said, what's your musical background? And the kid would say, gulp. I used to play in a garage band. And I said, that's fine. And what do you do now? I said, well, I still play in the garage band, gulp. So I said, well, that's part of your background. And that's going to be something that you have to deal with. And I don't see any reason why you have to throw it out. You have to find, maybe you want to go past that. You might take that as a place to jump off from, but you don't want to try to eschew yourself, because then you'll end up doing something you think is just being approved by other people. You've got to find out what you want to write. You have to write what you want. And in order to do that, you have to take into account your own background. And some of them had rock backgrounds. Several had done particularly well. Some among my students are people like Derek Brummel, who had both those things, but also was a world-class clarinetist. Gabrielle Elena Frank, who is also terrific pianist and has made a lot of hay as a composer using her mother's Peruvian background. David T. Little is suddenly very all over the place. I think he had some rock background, but also went to Princeton and so on. So he's suddenly very important in opera. And I'm proud of them all, because they found their own ways. And I think the ones which have done best have been the composers who found that they could find a way to integrate their own backgrounds with the whole world of music around them.
Let's sort of segue this notion of how to write music, you know, incorporating what you know, what you've been, what your own experience is, into this topic that you're going to be addressing tomorrow, Rethinking American Opera. I was looking over your most recent premieres, you know, the last 3-4 years, and there is a lot of vocal music, particularly solo vocal music.
And well, that's because the singers who wanted them, and that's just fine. I end up a lot of my much of what I do is commissions. People want something. I'll be doing a trombone concerto for Joseph Alessi in a couple of years, and he's the trombonist of the New York Philharmonic, so I'll do it with them, and that'll be fun. But I love working with different people. In fact, I very much want to get involved with the performer. That's always what I've done. I've always worked directly with them. I look at them as my collaborator, not just somebody who's going to just execute my notes. I need them because they're the ones who bring the piece across.
Well, and some of your own stage collaborations include working with film director Robert Altman on two operas, McTeague and A Wedding.
That's right.
A Wedding based on the
his own movie. Well, the whole idea I had was to take something that looked like it needed it. McTeague was, there's a famous silent movie named Greed, which was made from the novel McTeague. But Bob wanted to go not from that, but from the novel itself. And there's practically no spoken dialogue. So Arnold Weinstein, with whom I worked for many, many years, and wrote all the cabaret songs, which Joan premiered and have been done by singers all over the world now. He had to really make up all the dialogue. But Bob was very important in that he worked out the scenario, in which what has to happen in a particular scene. And when it came to the wedding, we had a problem, the fact that there were 48 people in that movie. They were double from the one from Nashville, which had been a big hit, and the wedding was not a big success. So, but the minute I saw it, I said, this is an opera, because everybody speaks from what they are. So it took a year to figure out to bring 48 people down to 16 people. And Bob and Arnold worked on that for all that time. And then this was a big gala for the 50th anniversary of Lyric Opera, so we got first-rate acting singers from all over the place. And it was just a terrific experience. I think you said you were there at the performance. And
No, that was the other fellow today we were talking to.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Sorry, we met so many people since we
Some other
here.
Guy.
Yeah, you know, but I mean, this was my last opera for Lyric. I did three operas for Lyric, which makes me the first person since Verdi to work for the same house, you know, several consecutive operas, which is something I'm very proud of.
Well, folks can hear more about what it means to rethink American opera, at least in the world of William Bolcom, and many, many, many composers, contemporary composers, are taking very different approaches to opera than used to be taken.
Mm-hmm. Has to be rethought.
Yeah, and that'll be tomorrow from 5 to 6:30, free at the Spurlock Museum on the University of Illinois campus in Urbana. And it's been my real great pleasure to have William Bolcom and Joan Morris here on Live and Local today. As I said at the outset, I never figured I'd get a chance to meet either one of you, and now here you both are in the same studio.
Well, thank you, Kevin. And pleasure.
Thanks for joining us on the show, and also for joining the folks at the School of Music to work with their students.
It's been our pleasure.
Our pleasure.
It's Live and Local on FM 90.9. And on tomorrow's program, we'll have a guest host. Roger Cooper will be hosting for me. And we will be airing an interview with Victor Goines, who is with the Jazz at Lincoln Center Orchestra, along with Wynton Marsalis. They'll be performing at the Bloomington Center for the Performing Arts, I believe, on Thursday. And also, we'll have some actors from Charleston Alley Theater's production of Miracle at 34th Street, and hopefully they have a couple of scenes there. And Vincent Trouth will guest host for me on Thursday. Roger will be back on Friday, and then I'll be back with you on Monday with a show. And I don't even know what's on the show on Monday. We'll announce it at some point leading up to then. WYLL is a member-supported service of the College of Media at Illinois. This is 90.9 WYLL FM and HD Urbana with translator W293 AF Danville, NPR, classical music, and more for Central Illinois. We're going to go out with some music by William Bolcom. This is the very end of his Capriccio, the final movement. I'm intrigued here. Gingando is the name.
Gingando is a marking you'll find in the Brazilian tangos of Ernesto Nazare, whose memory this last movement is. It's from my Capriccio. It's done by my friends Norman Fisher and his wife Jeannie. A fantastic recording of all my cello music.
Norman Fisher, the cellist, and Jeannie Kierman, the pianist.
That's right.
It's Live and Local on FM 90.9. Thanks for listening.